evening, everybody. Welcome back to Other Minds and Hands. Thank you for joining us at what in real time is a special time here, as we are joined by some old friends of the show, Dominic Nardi and Trevor Briarley, whom we had on before to talk about Dune. They are co-editors of a wonderful book of essays on Dune. And so, of course, Maggie and I, there it is, discovering Dune. Maggie and I were immediately thinking of having you guys back after we saw Dune and we spent some time talking about it. Would love to get some of your thoughts on the second Dune film, especially, which has really been, and, you know, well, I guess this will make, what, like 2.5 sessions that we've spent talking about Dune, Maggie?
I know, it's like, and one more excuse for us to keep talking about it.
Stop. Exactly. It's fun. But of course, for us, one of the reasons that we're really excited about this adaptation is because it was really good. You know, and this is one of the things that is so remarkable, I think. One of the things that we often talk about with adaptations is that the foremost responsibility of an adaptation is to tell a great story. So if you're going to make a movie from a book, your first responsibility is to make a great movie, right? Like that's what, and seeing what, it's been a long time since I have sat and been blown away by a film adaptation as I was blown away by the second Dune film. I just think it's one of the most successful adaptations I've seen in a very long time. And so therefore, a really interesting case study as we're looking at lots of different things. Looking at the different relationships that it has with the books, the different ways in which it's doing things, the kinds of decisions that it's making. Anyway, so that's one of the reasons why we've been so enthusiastic to talk about it. So first, what were your reactions? I can certainly relate as like a Tolkien guy going into a Tolkien adaptation. There's always some like trepidation, because like,
you
know,
Siskel and Ebert on us, you know.
No, exactly. Yeah. So, but just like, what was the experience for you? Because I know it's going to hit you guys a little bit different. I mean, just with the intimacy of your familiarity with the book, it's going to, you know, sort of hit you a little differently than it is going to hit a lot of people. What were your reactions? Trevor, let's start with you. What were your like main thoughts and reactions as you were watching the film?
There's a lot to love in this movie. The music continues to be fantastic. All the just gorgeous visual beauty to it. It's a very good adaptation. I agree with you on that. There are some troubling things about it. Some things that I thought might have been done a little bit better, but overall I was very impressed with it, and I think it will go down as one of the best adaptations of any science fiction story.
It's hard to think, especially in the science fiction world, it's hard to think of any obviously better examples in that regard.
And I think it was just this week that Steven Spielberg said it's the best science fiction film he's ever seen.
Mm.
What? You know?
Okay.
High praise.
Yeah, right?
Wow. I had not heard that. That's pretty impressive. Dom, how about you? What were your kind of reactions and responses?
So I'm admittedly a little bit more mixed, and I've only seen the film once, so I'm still in the processing phase. I had hoped to see it again, but I've just been a bit busy with life and work. I think, and this is where treating the film as a film versus treating the film as an adaptation versus treating the film as a visual supplement to the book, I think all yield different results. There's a lot, like, I think they did a lot right. Like, this is, I said, one of the things I said about this whole adaptation project was, you should not come away thinking that Paul is the good guy, that Paul is not Luke Skywalker, and I think they succeed hands down with that in this adaptation. They get the point of Dune. They get the message. There are a few adaptation choices, and a bit more action heavy than I had wanted. And I thought the action scenes dragged down a little bit, but they got the main point of the message. They did some interesting stuff with the characters. So a lot of good stuff, but I'm not quite at the hype level that I think a lot of Dune fans seem to be.
Yeah, I can really relate to that. I was blown away by the film, but I love Dune. I've loved Dune for a long time. But I'm not as, like, invested in Dune. Like, you can mess with Dune in ways that aren't going to bother me, that I would be more bothered if it were something that I were really sort of closer to. For instance. Yes, like, what Peter Jackson did to Faramir's character bothered me a lot more than what Villeneuve did with Jessica's character, for instance, right? Yes. So I can easily see how there were some things which I was sort of sitting back and being like, well, that was a bold move, right, that they just made there. But I could easily imagine some Dune fans being having a harder time with some of those things. Backing up to the kind of the biggest picture thing, what are some of the things that you felt thinking about? So, Dom, kind of picking up on what you were talking about Paul's character, right? What are some of the things that you, I mean, I'm not saying you necessarily go in with a list, but like things that you look for, like, you know, like, okay, if you're doing an adaptation, like if you really get Dune, right, you'll show us some of these things, right? Or like, what are some things that to do a really like obvious kind of example, like a Tolkien adaptation that I find to be a one of the biggest disappointments is the Shadows of Mordor video game series, right? And if you ask me to explain why, and that's an interesting example because by all accounts, from everyone that I've heard who played, it's a really good game, actually, right? So as like making an excellent version of like the primary medium that it is, it succeeded. Like they made a really good game, a really engaging game, a really fun to play game. But as a Tolkien adaptation, I consider it a failure because they like completely missed what seems to me to be the real heart of the story. Anytime you're making a story, a Tolkien story, in which someone is essentially making a ring and using it to dominate the wills of others in order to achieve revenge, I think you've missed some of the point of what the heart of that story is about. So thinking like sort of on those levels, what are things that like that you went like either that you saw in the film that you were thinking like, okay, like they really got this, they really sort of nailed some of these things, and what are some ways in which you felt it was that like the heart of the film was really in a different place than the heart of the book, if there were? I mean, I don't, maybe, you know, maybe there are some on either side, maybe not, but what do you think, Dom?
Starting with what I mentioned about Paul. Paul is not the quote-unquote hero, and that is core to Dune. That's core to not just the first Dune novel, but to the Dune saga, the critique of heroism and the hero's journey, cynicism about politics and leaders. That is a core theme in the novels, and it becomes really, really explicit in the later book. But it is there in the first book. And I think Villeneuve and Timothée Chalamet is a acting was incredible. Like, and he really can. He had presence. Mm-hmm. He had incredible screen presence, and the presence was not of a Marvel superhero. He was a young man finding his voice, who becomes cynical and manipulative, and who becomes callous and at times cruel. And Chalamet, I think, portrayed all that wonderfully in a way that. McLaughlin, I think it was in the original Lynch movie, just, you know, he was kind of the goody two-shoes version of Paul. So
right,
I think
right.
The film nailed that. On the other hand, though, the ending of the film with Shawnee leaving and that split in the relationship came across to me as a little bit too much like having your cake and eating it too. It was a bit too it almost made Shawnee the hero and Shawnee the voice of righteousness.
Yes.
Whereas in the new novel, there really isn't one. It's a bit more like the reader or the viewer in the movie is supposed to be at least somewhat complicit in Paul's rise. Whereas I felt like Shawnee leaving kind of almost gave the viewer a bit of an easy out and saying, well, okay, we're watching Paul become this cruel, callous emperor, but we side with Shawnee. Like, we know where we are. Like, right, like, you know, or I guess some viewers, I think, maybe didn't get the message. But, you know, like, it felt like a little bit of an out that the Dune novels never gave. They never, and most of the Dune novels don't have anybody who is really that sympathetic. Like, everybody's got their flaws and everybody's got their political machinations. So it's kind of ways that I think the movie succeeded, but also ways that I kind of think the adaptation differed from the book.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We spent some time talking about the Shawnee split, the split off of Shawnee there at the end. The way it was striking me was, I was talking last time a lot about how much the Dune novel lives in the interiority, like what percentage of the narrative is involved in telling us what Paul is thinking and how impossible that is to do on screen, right? So thinking of the kinds of choices that they're going to have to make in order to get at that interiority without having some tedious voiceover or someone narrating what Paul is thinking. And so the thing that I was thinking as I was sitting there in the theater with the Shawnee thing was Paul seemed at the end, Paul seemed like he'd like 100% gone over to that, as you say, more callous, more manipulative. Like he was doing his thing from the gathering, you know, where he like proclaimed himself and won the loyalty of all of the Southern Fremen through to the end. He was like, he was not evidencing outwardly any like self-doubt anymore. Whereas in the book, of course, like that, not just self-doubt, but even like self-loathing, like that, like, you know, I'm going to cause the jihad and the death of billions of people. And like, I don't want that. I'm trying to resist that, but it's not working. And, you know, like that problem within Paul, you know, the whole time. So it felt to me like they were kind of externalizing that with Shawnee, right? That like Shawnee was the voice of resistance, like that was still there. And but I hadn't been thinking about it, Dom, in the terms that you were using. And I like that way of constructing it, that it's not just, because I was thinking of it as almost like splitting Paul's own internal dilemma into the two characters, which has the unfortunate side effect of making Shawnee like an extension of Paul, you know, in that sense at the end, which is not real satisfying. But that idea of splitting off the hero part, like the, you know, having the, not just as an extension of Paul, but as the, you know, as he shifts from hero into, you know, a sort of, anyway, not comfortable hero mode at the end, to kind of preserve her as this sort of location for hero focus, you know, and hero appreciation. I think it's a really interesting way to think about it. And I agree with you that we do not get that kind of relief in the book. It would be nice at the end of the book to be left with a character that we could be really excited about moving forward. But we are not given that in the book, for sure.
Or they're all killed off.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Surviving character that we can... exactly.
You guys see that as kind of a strength of the film, potentially, that there is this kind of oomph to move into film three. There is an enthusiasm to see where it goes, where we don't necessarily have that optimism at the end of the book.
I don't know, because I've read the book and I read Dune Messiah, so I know where the story's supposed to go. I'm not entirely sure how people who have not read the books, where they think the story's going. And I almost wonder if the ending with Shawnee just riding off into the desert is a bit too ambiguous. Again, I don't, trying to put myself, like, initially I was like, oh wait, is she going to start, like, is she riding off to try to raise a rebellion against Paul, or is she just going on like a joyride, like taking the Corvette out for a spin just to vent off something? if I hadn't read the book, I might not even realize that, like, Paul and Chani are supposed to actually stay together, and maybe Denny Villeneuve's version of Dune Messiah is going to change that.
Here's the wacky thought: maybe they're setting us up for her to be the desert prophet instead of Paul.
I definitely think they're setting us up to not discount her yet, because as somebody that hasn't read it as much as you guys, and it's been a long time since I've, you know, even read it through once, it felt very much like that scene earlier in Dune 2 where he goes off to do his trial in the desert and she kind of sneaks up and follows him just to make sure he's okay and then helps him out and teaches him everything. I kind of feel like there's something of that foundation laid that we shouldn't discount Chani, but I don't know if that's going to come fruition or not. I just feel like, as a viewer, they're laying some foundations for us to be like, I don't know, I guess we'll see about everybody. And
yeah, I mean, the general impression I was left with, and I could easily imagine, Dom, her becoming a sort of a locus of resistance, especially since the division within the Fremen society is something that was amply set up before. So imagining that there's going to be a faction of disaffected Fremen is something, certainly, if it happens, what has led up to this in the film, we shouldn't be surprised if that were to happen. But more, it almost felt to me just like a sort of protest, right? Like, yeah, all the Fremen, like, but I'm going to have nothing to do with this, right? Like, I wash my hands of this, and I'm like, I didn't get the sense necessarily that she was setting off to accomplish something. It was just like, I'm distancing myself from this. And in particular, especially with the way that, riding the worms was established in this second film. The application of the iconic sight of her standing there with her hooks, right, getting ready to and calling a worm, provided this sense of like, okay, the Fremen, whom we see on the one hand, most of the Fremen, right, boarding ships in order to go off and fight a war off world, that is, they have lost their way. Like, Paul has lost his way, and he's leading all of them to lose their way. That's the Shani's doing the Fremen way, right? She is like returning to the desert, you know, with her hooks, and that there was like a purity of, you know, I don't know what, a Fremenism to that, right? That the other Fremen were being taken away from, you know, by Paul in the direction that he was leading them. But wow, Trevor, I had never thought of that possibility. I'm trying not to think of it. So I've decided, by the way, I'm not going to reread Dune Messiah. It's been ages since I've read Dune Messiah, and I'm not going to reread it before the next film comes out, because I'm going to try and experiment with myself where I watch the film first and then review the book afterwards. But I remember Dune Messiah well enough to get that reference. And, like, so I remember just enough for it to kind of blow my mind what you were just suggesting there. That is really fascinating. Trevor, thoughts that you had about this kind of big picture, like, things that you felt were, you know, really concordant or discordant with the book in your impression?
I was actually really impressed with the, maybe more visually than, because I understand there's, with the Harkonnen, there's some interesting things with the way they were portrayed. But I think visually, the scenes in Gedi Prime, just absolutely mind-blowing, very much communicating this sense of sinister vileness and will to power. And that whole Leni Riefenstahl wide shots, all of that was just absolutely amazing. And I have to do a shout out to the oil fireworks, because I thought that was a brilliant way, a little leitmotif that communicates a lot about the Harkonnen as being kind of oily and slippery and,
yes,
you know, not nice and clean like regular fireworks. So that I thought they did really well, at least visually. I was troubled a bit. I was very excited about the way they portrayed the Fremen in the first movie. I thought they really captured something about them. In the second movie, they kind of go back to being a stereotype of religious, you know, you have religious fanatics and you have the skeptics and
the secular skeptics. Yeah,
exactly. So it became very much, you know, they were still monolithic. They were monolithic because it was all about religion one way or the other. And for example, one of the things I thought kind of tied into that was the scenes in the Siege. Siege Tabor is very cold and austere. It's stone carvings. And there's just this whole swath of beautiful things in the book about life in the Siege that are just completely left out. And I found that very, I found it disappointing. And
yeah,
I like Hara. I wish they put Hara in, but
right. Yeah, Hara, that's Jamis's wife, right? That Paul inherits. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, goodness, I was missing sharply. Missing toddler Aaliyah, but it was fun. I heard a reviewer say, I think like the way that they just had her communicating with her in the womb was even more unsettling, and I'm like, no, like, I mean, unsettling, yes, more unsettling than like toddler Aaliyah. No, actually, toddler Aaliyah would be way more unsettling than like an unspoken telepathic communication, you know, between you, because that's almost all in the imagination. It's the sight. It's like the uncanny valley effect of, you know, the toddler with human memories and human vocabulary, you know, running around and, you know, like making like sexual innuendo jokes at Hara and stuff, you know, is like, that's way weirder and creepier than the telepathic communication with the fetus. But in my opinion, anyway, yeah. So I agree that I felt it was one of the strangest and in its way most intrusive of the changes, and again, Maggie and I talked about this some too. That division between the zealot Fremen and the secular Fremen, which I don't know. Like it was strange. It felt strange to me. Certainly a huge kind of change. Do you think? The vague impression that I got is that it presented at least a certain amount of increased agency, I think, perhaps, on the part of the Fremen. And if you didn't have... So I'm trying to play the game I often play when I'm trying to figure these things out, and that is imagining if it were different. Right. So, okay, like, what would the film have been like if there hadn't been that secular voice, if there hadn't been that voice of resistance, with Chani at the center of it? But anyway, that sense of it, if we hadn't had that, if all of the Fremen had been like Stilgar, right, and responding sort of uniformly all the way through in, you know, in unquestioning response to the prophecies, right, of the Lizan al-Ghaib and all that kind of thing. What would the effect have been? What would it have looked like? And I think it would have felt like just kind of a kind of blurring over, like a blurring together of the whole culture, you know? Okay, you know what it reminds me of kind of weirdly? This is a strange parallel, but hear me out. It's like the dwarves in The Hobbit, right? So when Bilbo is in the company of 13 dwarves in the book, right, we're asked to imagine a big crowd of dwarves in Bilbo, and we're told their names, and we're even told the colors of their hoods and that sort of thing. But apart from the colors of their hoods, there's very little to distinguish most of the dwarves, right? You know, there's there's Bao in the Lookout, and there's Thorin, and there's Fili and Kili, the nephews of the younger ones who are the nephews of Thorin, and there's Bomber the fat one. But there, I mean, what's the difference between Bifur and Bofur? Nobody knows, right? Nobody could tell the difference between those two. In a book, it's easy to kind of take a collective group of people like that, choose one or two representatives like Balin and like Dory to talk sometimes and do a couple things. But you don't have to, like Tolkien never did. And even to the extent to which he did give different dialogue to different of the, he pulled it back and like in revision and reallocated some of the dialogue to a smaller number of dwarves. Because it's easier in a book to just choose representative characters, have them stand for the whole, and then we don't have to kind of worry about it. That works well in a book. On film, when Peter Jackson goes to adapt The Hobbit, one of the first thing he does, right, if you remember back in like 2010, 2011, one of the first things that he was doing was releasing pictures of all 13 dwarves, right, which were wildly different from each other, down to the one with the axe lodged in his skull, right? That's going pretty far out of your way to make them idiosyncratic and memorable, right? But they were committed to that. I'm not saying, and obviously, look, I'm not suggesting the Hobbit films are like an obvious example of what to do, but that trend, right, of saying, because like you can't just have like we're a faceless crowd going around with you if people are seeing them, right? You've got to, there's more pressure, I think, in a visual production to connect with the individual characters, right?
And there's a lot less opportunity. Sorry, I'm chiming in here.
Please.
A lot less opportunity to attach as well. So you have to have these visual cues to separate when it's in such a large group. But to the point that it becomes a little bit twee sometimes, that, you know, yes, I'm the one with an axe in my head. I'm the one with a quirky sense of humor. Like, it becomes, like, part of my personality to have this idiosyncratic difference. I don't think we need that with Fremen. So no. I feel like some of the differences we do get are more subtle,
right?
But also more clear, right? Like, we only have A or B. That will be what separates you and delineates you and makes you unique. So it's more clear to those of us that, you know, don't know the inner nuances of religion and belief within this community.
Yes.
I think even in the book, the Fremen are not portrayed as monolithic, even in their, you know, how they come to believe in Paul. There is a transition where some believe right up at the front and some believe further on. Some see miracles in that. So I think it's possible to show the fact that people came at different points to it without, I think, creating this huge gap where you have everybody on one side, everybody on the other side, they all kind of believe the same depending on what side they're on. I think that maybe wasn't necessary.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and that's what it seemed, because you're right, there are shades, though I think in general, I mean, certainly compared to the film with this massive divide, as you're talking about, the book depicts the Fremen as closer to monolithic. As you say, there are shades. Like, there's that moment, which I always think is a really important moment in the book, when he realizes that Stilgar has become a follower and no longer a friend, right? Like, he's now become a disciple. And that he's lost him in that way. But that's like way at the end when he has that realization. So with my parallel with The Hobbit, it's not exactly like, so Maggie, the risk that they're taking is not the same risk of, like, as you say, it becoming a little twee, right? And being like, I'm the one who always like does this, and I'm the one who always like makes this kind of joke or something. But still the need to differentiate, like to not just have, because in a book you can allude to a group, you can allude to a category of people, right? And we can, you know, our imagination can kind of fill in differences and stuff, but you don't have to present a distinction there. Just as, again, it's okay to have a whole bunch of faceless dwarves in The Hobbit, but it would be less okay in a film adaptation, to just have a bunch of faceless hobbits, some of whom never get a line of dialogue, even though they're trooping around with them all the way through, which is totally true in the book. With the Fremen, even though there are, Trevor, those differences in particular characters, and we're told we... But most of that, you see, we get through Paul's interiority. Like, he's thinking about the Fremen, right? And he's like, well, some of them, you know, are complete zealots and, like, think I can walk on water if there were water. And then some of them, that's a really bad illustration in the Dune context. I guess there is enough water for him to walk on if he, you know, if anyone would dare to walk on the pools of water. Anyway, never mind. Point is... We do get that, but we don't see it as in the characters so much as we hear about it in Paul's thinking, right? That one scene with Stilgar when he, like, acknowledges that he's shifted like that. Some of the progress in the time gap that they took out in the film, right? Like, I'm thinking in particular of the scene, for instance, when Chani comes in from having killed a challenger, right? Because it's become a nuisance. How many people have, like, come in to challenge Muad'Dib, you know, to trial by combat? And so she killed him for him so that he didn't have to. And that might help to discourage people if they knew that, you know, Muad'Dib's woman might kill you and you would get no honor from that. You know, that scene shows a point in progress, right, of him finding his place in Fremen society. But still, I feel that in the book, the Fremen as a whole are kind of lumped much more, and they seem to want to say, not only the Fremen aren't uniform in their beliefs, but also, like, they're not all suckers. Like, the fact that they chose to have not just a differentiation. They could have done a differentiation just of resistiveness, right? Like, some who are quick to accept Paul and some who are slower to accept Paul. You could have done that on the premise of, like, I don't care, you're still an outsider and you still haven't earned my respect yet, right? Like, that was cool what you've done now, but, like, I'm still reserving judgment and whatever. I still don't think you're the Lisan al-Gaib, right? But to instead to have these, like, secular, we are skeptical of all of this, you know, Bene Gesserit manipulation that is happening through this folklore tradition, seem to me to give this sort of handle, you know, for people to be able to be like, okay, so the Fremen aren't all idiots, right? There are some Fremen who are onto things. But of course then they lose. Right? So anyway. I don't know.
I think one part of the context is, had the Fremen been more, not quite monolithic, but had they been a bit more uniform in their dedication to religion and accepting of Paul, I think that would have undermined Paul's arc, in that it would have looked to a 21st century audience like a white savior story. Now, we can go into why the original Dune novel is not a white savior story, but it would take hours of podcasting to explain that, and a movie doesn't have hours of time to explain that. So having some Fremen resist and making clear that this is not just a white savior coming in to an ignorant, you know, uniform people with no personality, but giving them that differentiation, giving them some elements of resistance, and some acknowledgement of, you know, some of the Fremen themselves say that, hey, it's kind of weird that there's this outsider coming into our culture, acknowledging that up front, but then showing, you know, the corruption of the culture as Paul, you know, through his charisma, but also through his prescient powers, wins more and more of them over. I think makes it more a story of political power and, you know, the corruption of that power through religious authority than a quote-unquote white savior story.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, and that is certainly an obvious problem. I agree that, you know, people who characterize the book as just a white savior story, I agree with you. I don't think that that is correct, but you're right that it's complicated, you know, and a superficial, it's easy to see how on a superficial reading you can think that, right? Which means it's something to be very cautious of in doing the film, because I think it'd be even easier on film to make it look like that. So yeah, no, that is important. You know, I was mentioning the scene with Stilgar in the book, or Paul thinking about Stilgar in the book. On the one hand, I can't think of any alternative to making Stilgar the kind of spokesperson for the religious fundamentalist Fremen faction, right? That is to say, they didn't have anybody else who could have been. You know, they had Stilgar and Chani, right, as the two sort of spokespeople of those. And they didn't have enough well-developed Fremen characters to have somebody else in that role. But I missed... Not only did I miss Book Stilgar in this way, because there were times when I felt that it made film Stilgar look like a fool. You know, when he was saying things like, you know, like that line when it's like, it proves that it is the prophecy when he denies that he's fulfilling the prophecy, right? Like, it's like, okay, Stilgar, right? Like, I mean, just like any kind of like respect for his intellectual capacity is really kind of like going down when you hear him talking like that, right? Whereas even like in the first film, I think of this scene when Stilgar comes to meet Leto, right? Duke Leto. That's a strong scene, right? And the way in which he is like, I love the way that he, I'm forgetting the actor who played.
Javier Bardem,
yeah. The way that Javier Bardem played that scene was just awesome. I absolutely loved Stilgar in that scene. There was this really strong sense of, I don't care what you say your, you know, customs are, you're on Arrakis now and this is how I do things, and I'm not changing how I do things in order to please you. But then he seemed to, like, it seemed to be a significant weakening of him and of his character to turn him into the spokesperson of the zealots in the second film. That was one little disappointment that I had there.
I didn't feel that, but I can see that. And I think I know the moments you're talking about where, like, it made him seem a little foolish, but it didn't make him seem the fool to me. It was evidencing, you know, that kind of religious blind belief without me kind of thinking less of him. It was like, oh, it's his faith, you know. And that word I thought was quite strong throughout the second film too, and the princess continuously referring to it, you underestimate faith. It made it more powerful how she referred to it. So seeing him as kind of the lead in that regard fit, but I can absolutely see how, like, if you love Book Stilgar and he's making these comments, you're rolling your eyes going, seriously, Stilgar, come on, it could have been anybody else. Right. Yeah, I can see why that decision would be made, but I can also see how that decision would be a little bit tough.
Yeah. Let's talk, Trevor, you raised the remarkable scene on Gaiety Prime, the Harkonnen scene. Let's talk a little bit more about the depictions of the Harkonnen. Dom, I know that you were thinking before about some of the significant differences in the treatment of the Harkonnen. What do you think? Not just thinking in terms of, like, you know, sort of like point for point variations, but sort of bigger picture. What do you see as, like, the... is a clumsy way to ask the question, but like the role of the Harkonnens in the story, like the place and purpose of them in the story in the films compared to the place and purpose of them in the books.
Yeah. So big picture for me, So in the film, I thought what Denis Villeneuve did with the Harkonnen was really interesting, but it was also very off-putting. And I don't mean that in an adaptation sense. I just mean that they were really quite vile, and they are not people I want to spend a lot of time with. And very, 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 very violent. But in the book, I've come to see the Harkonnen as they're obviously villains. You know, they're villains, but they are they're on a spectrum. So, you know, some great houses are more villainous than others. The Harkonnens are villainous, and initially, readers are supposed to think the House Atreides are the good guys, and they're the counterpoint to the Harkonnens. But there are clues, not just with Paul and the arc we've been talking about, but even Duke Leto, there are clues that, well, he is also cynical. He's also manipulative. There's a in the scene in the first film where, you know, they're going to rescue the spice harvesters and the ornithopter. In the book, Duke Leto's like, well, make sure to take notes on this for my propaganda videos, and, you know, so we can celebrate. You know, there's a very cynical part of his authority, to the extent where, you know, I've seen a lot of scholarship on Dune argue basically that, like, you know, the Atreides are just good-looking Harkonnens. You know, they look they're more charismatic. They have better hair. They look, you know, they speak more articulately. But at the end of the day, like, the line between them is a bit thin, or you know, it's not non-existent, but it's thin. Whereas in the movie, the Harkonnens are almost come across as another species, like almost like orcs. You know, just they're all bald, they all look uniform, they're all very oily. So I don't get the sense that the film is prompting us to think there's a thin line between the Atreides and the Harkonnen. Maybe Paul and his, you know, political corruption is evil, but it's a different type of evil from the Baron. They're different spectrums.
Yeah, not just bald, hairless, right? I mean, like, the close-up pictures of Fade Rautha, I'm like, is he even a mammal?
He's not even eyelash.
I know. No eyelashes, no eyebrows. I mean, that was so creepy. That was so creepy. And exactly that way, like, this is not a... I'm not looking at a normal human being. Again, especially the super close-ups of his face. It was just, I'm like, yeah, that was enormously, enormously creepy. And I agree with you, the way in which even the, you know, and this is also a little bit David Lynch too, but the whole, like, the way the Baron flies everywhere. Right, you know, that particular deployment of his suspensors, which is a huge exaggeration of what the suspensors do in the book. Right, in the book, they lift some of his weight so that he is able to move much quicker on his feet than you would expect a man of his bulk to be able to do. Right. And they do, like, when he dies, there's that funny description, right, of he's, like, collapsed and fallen over, but his suspensors don't let him fall all the way to the ground, so he's, like, awkwardly lying at an angle in midair, right, as he's... But he doesn't, like... He's not, like, a remote-control airplane controlled by himself, you know, kind of hovering around, you know, is like the Duke drone. But again, Trevor, I'm coming back to this whole, like... not human thing, right? The way that we always see him rising out of the mud with no obvious way that he's breathing under there, right? Like, he doesn't come up with a breathing apparatus and take it off. He just, like, emerges like, yes, I was breathing mud. Thank you very much. I shall now return to my amphibious lair, right? In this vat of mud. I mean, it was, but why? Like, I want to push this one step further, because I agree with that. I think it's a really important observation, that they have set in their visual depiction, they set the Harkonnens apart from everybody else. The only, actually, you know, the only other people that seemed as unpeople-like to some extent is that were the Sardaukar. The Sardaukar also had a kind of an atmosphere of not normal humanity about them. But then again, at least they had eyebrows. So there was that.
I think I'm going to have to push a little bit on this concept of the Atreides being, you know, not so far from the Harkonnen. Because I really think Herbert goes out of his way to draw a very clear distinction, a moral distinction between the Atreides and the Harkonnen. And he's not doing that because he's necessarily, you know, pro Atreides and he thinks they're the good guys, and because he makes a very clear transition to Paul being the leader of an enormous massacre. So they start out at a very high moral place. They're portrayed that way at least, and they need a counterpoint which is going to be just as vile in the opposite direction. And I think it's possible to argue that in the movie they do kind of go over the top, but there does have to be this polarity between the two in order for it sets it up for that fall to be higher of the Atreides.
Yeah, especially the way in which, okay, so this is me trying to answer my own question about like the so what question, right? What is the impact of the inhumanity of the Harkonnens as they depict it? And Trevor, I think you're right. The way in which Paul at the end not only realizes that he is half Harkonnen, but almost embraces it. Like his last conversation with the Baron, I mean, he kills him. You know, he takes vengeance on the Baron for killing his father and destroying his house. And yet there's lots of irony in that moment, right? Like, I am becoming a Harkonnen. I am acting like that. I'm going to out Harkonnen the Harkonnens here. As of course, like almost literally what he's unleashing on all the other planets is like the Harkonnen, is like the Baron, you know, unleashing, what's his name? Blanking.
Raban,
yeah. Beast Raban on Arrakis, right? It's not exactly the same, but there's some similarities there. And I think perhaps if that, Trevor, really is the trajectory, like that is if we see Paul really as truly embodying half Atreides, half Harkonnen there at the end, the like total subhumanity of the Harkonnens really kind of brings home the extent of Paul's fall there. Yeah, I wonder if it's a way of making that connection really viscerally hit us as well. That is, Paul turning out to be a Harkonnen, like realizing that he is half Harkonnen.
I think we have to identify with Paul at the beginning.
Yeah.
We have to be engaged and we have to be a part of his trajectory. At some point we get off. Yeah. And realize, maybe this guy is not a good guy.
Right. Right.
And it seems to me, you know, Frank Herbert really wants us to get that message. He wants us to understand that heroes, superheroes are a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he starts us out very much interested in a superhero. And then we see how that progresses to jihad.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about this a little bit last week of why we focus so much on Paul, and, you know, purely just for nobody is, if someone comes completely unassociated with Dune and has no idea anything about the book or anything, they're going to need something to latch on to. So Paul's an excellent through line because he shows every part of the story that we need to see. He is the reason that a lot of this stuff moves forward. So keeping us on Paul's side for pretty much the duration of the second film too, I feel like is a really good hook, because we've got all of films one and two to latch on to this idea, to see him as the humble, wonderful, lovely leader. You know, it's just, oh, he deserves this moment. Yeah. So when he does step into it, you're kind of like, oh, dang. You know, so I feel like that is really going to hit come the third film, because he's put the time in to make Paul feel like the good guy.
And it's a good part. I will say, given that the Harkonnen were so like inhuman and greasy and slimy, like it's impressive that the film doesn't try to quote unquote humanize them or make them sympathetic villains, which is a trend in a lot of pop culture films these days. Like even Thanos in the Marvel films was, you know,
yes,
he had a point. You know, he
yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But like Dune doesn't try to do that to an extent I almost found surprising, yet it also still manages to end with Paul not being the good guy. Like I think it would have been very easy for us to, for audiences to think, oh well, like Paul is killing this really disgusting evil guy, ergo he is good. But like the film I think actually manages that tension pretty well.
Yeah, actually that's another interesting thing. How evil was Baron Harkonnen in the film? See, one cue that the book gives us that we don't get in the film, that they did not do in the film, is the Baron's pedophilia, right? That's like one cue that the book seems to be giving us to say, like, just in case you were not clear on the fact that the Baron is a completely despicable person, right? Here's another little nugget for you to make sure you don't miss it, right? Whereas in the film, Raban is bad, ruthless in any case. Fade Rautha is quite horrible, enjoys killing random people for fun, including, you know, like his servants who seem to be there just waiting for the time when he wants to lash out and kill them, right? But the Baron, am I forgetting? Was I so overwhelmed by Fade Rautha that I'm overlooking it? But I mean, apart from
there is a tiny, tiny scene where for about like 3 seconds you do see some dead, naked bodies in.
Well, and right before that, there's some ungodly screaming.
Yeah.
Oh, right, because he just killed the women who were, that's
so
right.
So we don't get to see it. He slaughtered,
that's all you get, though.
Throws their bodies
that's
in
right.
the corner.
Yeah, that's all you get.
Okay, there. So he did have a bit of a tantrum there. That's true. Yeah, I had forgotten that scene. But mostly he's depicted as, like, again, ruthless, right? Calculating. Not, you know, doesn't stick it much in his plans to get ahead, right, and to accomplish his goals. I forgot about the slaughtering his attendants scene.
I see what you're saying, though, but like of the crew that we see from that world, he's the most like functional, right? Like
the most functional. Like, yes,
he is calculated, he is strategic, he is in want of power but by making things work well, whereas the other people are just ruthless and psychotic. He actually wants to be very good at his job. He's still a jerk and he's still a horrible person or being, but yeah, it's so hard to navigate some of these terms, isn't it? But I also really liked that one moment at the very end, right before he does die, where his last action is to try to climb the steps towards the throne. Mm-hmm. So, like, there is this moment where, like, regardless of good, bad, whatever, he still wants power, and he wants to sit on that throne and know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice little subtle visual cue.
I think for a different understanding of how you could do the Baron is the Sci-Fi Channel version of the Baron. He's almost charming.
Right.
He's very coherent, and he's a plotter and he's a schemer. And they really kind of minimize the, you know, more gross elements that you see in some of the other adaptations or even the book itself. So,
yeah,
it's a good example of how you can depict things in different ways to get a similar result. Like, we just need to see him as other.
Yeah.
Other. Yeah. I'm thinking of the scene when he escapes the poison by flying up towards the ceiling. In what looked like, I wasn't sure, but it looked to me almost like a visual nod to this scene in Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, when Dracula's climbing up along the wall, right? Again, it's just like not human, really, really other. They don't even realize, you know, that he's up there, because that's the up top corner of the ceiling is not where you look for people, you know, when you go into the room. That otherness was really very striking. And I do think, Trevor, I keep coming back to the point that you were saying, the way in which it does, because Paul is very other in other ways, and for other, like his you know, his prescience, which, by the way, did they ever use that word in the film? Prescient?
I don't think so.
They did. I was waiting for it.
Very much, but minimize it.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, they talked about prophecy, and they talked about, you know, the like visions and stuff. But they, anyway, just, well, I didn't know if I missed it. But anyway, in all of these ways, Paul is, he's also been made other by Jessica and the Bene Gesserit training that she has given him, which also like awakens this stuff in Paul. Cause there's a scene, and again, I don't think I'm making this up though. Cause there was a scene in the film as well, right? When he's angry at her and, you know, for what she did to him, like that, you know, that she did this, you know, and he yells at her, like, you did this to me, something. Am I making that up? That actually happened, didn't it? Anyway, that
happened. And in the book, when that happens, he uses the term freak.
Like, yes.
Freak.
I'm a freak. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So Paul is other in a different way in the book. And they do seem to be going way out of their way to make the Harkonnens very much other in a different way. And so I'm wondering, again, thinking about those two sort of others sort of coming together. They certainly come into the parallel between Paul and Fade Rautha, which is established, I thought, more forcefully in the book than in the film. In the book, you're very aware of the fact that, like, those two parallel results of the Bene Gesserit breeding program are, you know, come into conflict and are in some sense kind of like mirror images and alternatives of each other, right? But in the film, that didn't seem quite as clear. More on this. We've talked about the Baron. What do you make of Fade Rautha and Fade Rautha's role in this? Especially, again, the way in which the culmination of the film is the duel between Paul and Fade Rautha, right? So it all seems to kind of build up to the direct conflict between the two of them.
I thought they were trying to create that parallel, and we can discuss whether it was effective, but I actually thought it was really interesting that they had Margot Fenring give Fade the Gamgubar test. And that seemed to me a really clear, like, Paul did this in the first film, Fade's doing it in the second film. Now, I don't think anybody is going to, if you look at that and say, well, Fade is potentially the hero of the story, because he's obviously not a hero. But I thought there was a parallel, and I thought it was also interesting when they discussed his, you know, with Paul, when he took the Gamgubar test, he passed. but we didn't quite get the sense that the Bene Gesserit thought they could control him. With Fade, when we hear the Bene Gesserit, they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, we can manipulate him. Like, he's...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got like several levers him. Here, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, we can take care of him. So there is that parallel, but there is also, I think, a clear sense that, like, Fade wasn't going to be the big shot. Like, he wasn't going to be the guy who became the charismatic leader. Like, he was... He had the baser instincts were controlling him in some ways.
I think in the book, the Baron has set him up or wants him to become a heroic savior figure. He wants him, you know, yes. Raban's going to just make a mess and Fade Roth is going to come in and clean it up.
Yes.
So I have often wondered whether the bit, you know, that chapter where we see him in the gladiator pits.
Yes.
That is setting him up for us to potentially understand what the Baron is going to say later about him becoming a savior figure. So maybe we're supposed to get a hint that Fade Roth is kind of a contrasting savior figure to Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or at least being groomed to kind of fulfill that
right.
role.
Right, yeah. Right.
But I think the Bene Gesserit comment about controlling him would suggest that even if the Baron wanted him to be that savior, he just wasn't gonna, in the movie at least, he didn't have the potential to fulfill that role.
Right. No, it felt like rather than him being in that sense an alternative to Paul, like the Baron's alternative, obviously, but even in a broader sense, even from the Bene Gesserit's perspective, an alternative to Paul. I felt like the film was setting him up more as a caricature of Paul, if that's the right way to say it. Because notice we didn't get a parallel discussion. I'm thinking again of that in-house Bene Gesserit analysis of Fade Rautha that we got, right? We heard the, you know, teacher's room breakdown of the Gom Jabbar test, right? For Fade Rautha, which we didn't get for Paul, right? We didn't hear the Reverend Mother talking to other Bene Gesserits, not Jessica. We got a little bit with Jessica and the Reverend Mother afterwards, but that was not focused in the same way, certainly not the same kind of conversation. So again, we're getting that sort of behind the scenes. And so the thing is that yes, like he's able to be manipulated. Whereas of course, Paul in declaring himself the Lisan al-Gaib is also kind of like at least engaged with the game of the Bene Gesserits, right? Being set up by them, but also him trying to control them and take control of that particular, you know, him using them instead of them using him in the same way. And so having the two of them face each other, there was almost more of a, I don't know, it wasn't I keep wanting to compare it to something like a photo negative version of Paul. But that's an awkward kind of parallel, because it's not like he was the opposite to him in every way. In some ways, he's just like the pure depiction of what Paul could fall to, right? I mean, Fade Rautha is, in fact, an excellent killer. And the signature... And this, of course, is strongly emphasized in the book. Fade Rautha's signature as a fighter, but as a character too, is betrayal, deception. Right? I will not follow the rules, and you will never know where the poison is coming from. Right? That's what defines Fade Rautha. His whole like career, right? And Paul, I don't know. It's again, it's almost like, on the one hand, Fade Rautha represents or seemed to point to what Paul could become if he kept, you know, the Baron was almost like what he was falling to. Fade Rautha was what he could yet become, essentially. I don't know. As I say, that it was one thing that with the film, in the book, the conflict at the end feels sort of satisfying. It feels almost like destined, the way those two characters are coming together. In the film, I think because the film depicts the battle so much more, the end of the book is always noteworthy for me, in that we build up the huge Battle of Arakeen, right? And the stratagem with the atomics and the sandworms and everything, and it's going to be awesome. But we don't, like, see it. Like, we're told that it's going to happen, and then we're told that it succeeds. We get, like, maybe a paragraph telling us about it. But what we certainly don't get is what we were given in the films, right? Like, what it would actually have been like. And I cannot blame them for that. Like, that's phenomenal. And I was so pleased. I felt like that scene in the film gave me what I always wanted but never got from Dune. But afterwards, I started feeling guilty. I'm like, I kind of have to feel like Herbert could have given that to me, but he didn't for a reason. Right? And so I wonder how much they've lost by giving it to me, you know, by doing, approaching that so very differently from the way Herbert did. Go ahead.
I very much want to hear both of your opinions on the end of this and moving into the next one. But just in terms of that point, you should not feel guilty about a scene that brings you joy in an edit because it fulfills a gap that we're missing from a word-based medium. If a visual storytelling can do it the way that makes you happy, that's okay.
No, it's not guilt. It was like the way in which the lack of the epic satisfaction, you know, Dama, as you've been saying, like, there are no heroes, right? And the heroic charge at the end would have created a kind of satisfaction in the ending that Herbert seems intent on denying us. I never find the battle at the end or the final resolution at the end of the book satisfying at all. And I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to find it satisfying. That if, you know, if I left all pumped up, if I left the book, right, all pumped up and excited and like, that was awesome, the good guys won, that, like, Herbert would hate that, right?
Not the charge of the Rohirrim.
It's not the charge of the Rohirrim, no. But
I think he portrays that. One of the things I think is worthy of note is the that final battle between Fade Rautha and Paul. Paul is severely injured, mm-hmm. which I don't think occurs in the book. He is, you know, almost killed. And I think that really kind of breaks that narrative that you see so often in the good versus evil, where the good guy triumphs and he's almost unhurt. And I think the movie really gives us a picture of Paul is not a hero. He's fallible. He's taken a lot of damage. He's barely standing. He's not the superhero that we expect. And I thought that was a brilliant move, because here again, you have to show it rather than tell it when you're doing a movie. So I thought that was, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, the wound that he took was interesting. I wasn't surprised that they deviated from the mechanism, the, like, needle in the belt mechanism that Fade Rautha was going to use to poison him. Because it could theoretically have been done, but it would have been really hard to see, and it would have been also, like, I think on screen it would have looked bizarrely sexual as well. I mean, like the whole hip to hip thing. I just, there's a lot of things I think have been weird about it if they depicted him. Maggie, I don't know if you know what I'm referring to. So in the film, in the book version, Fade Rautha's gonna poison him. He's got a poison needle on his belt. So it's like at his hip and it comes out and they're like rolling on the ground. And the whole like thing at the end is he's on top of Paul and he's like twisting his hips, trying to get the needle into him. Right. And Paul has to like, he calls out the code word that's going to make his muscles lock up. And then he pushes him off and saves himself and stuff. But like, yeah, the whole thing with the like wrestling on the floor and the poison needle, like I don't think would have come across. It would have been weird.
And the hip thrusting.
And the hip thrusting. Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, I'm going to try to win with, like, a pelvic thrust. Like, it's just, it would have been awkward in certain ways.
It just would have given a very, yeah, and, like, not just to make jokes about it, but that would have just added a different dynamic that we don't have the time to explore in a quick visual medium, you know? But having this sharp, intense, well-trained hand-to-hand combat was pretty good.
Yes. Yeah, and, of course, the way that it, you know, picked up from the very first fight scene with Gurney Halleck in the training room, right? The high knife, and then, you know, we would have joined each other in death, you know, moment at the beginning there. Look down, lad, right? You know, that whole moment. That was a very satisfying. I was really pleased with the payoff from that scene. Not only that in the end, but man, if there was one moment that like brought me to tears in the second film, it was when he talks about how he recognized that he knew Gurney from his footsteps, right? In the sand. Like, and oh man, like the reunion between Gurney and Paul was my wife, it was one of those scenes where my wife gave me this weird look, because as soon, like at the very beginning of that scene, as soon as they showed the like old decrepit spice harvester being lowered to the ground, I knew it was going to be the smugglers and Gurney Halleck finally come in. So I was like, yes. As soon as I saw like the decrepit thing dropping down, I was like, yes. My wife was like, what are you cheering for? You know, the decrepit spice crawler. But, and that scene totally did not disappoint. More though about that closing battle, how do you think it, especially relating to heroism and stuff, Dom, as you say, the attack of the Fremen on Arakeen there at the end is not the charge of the Rohirrim, right? But by getting that battle was designed to hit us in certain ways that I don't think we got hit in the book. And that's why, so Maggie, that's what I was referring to. Again, it wasn't guilt. It was, as I was enjoying it, I was like, I'm enjoying this, which means this film is taking me to a very different place than I was being conscious of being taken to a very different place. And knowing I did indulge myself in enjoying the scene when I was watching it, but I was like, note, I'm going to really have to think about this carefully later on, because, you know, I'm enjoying this and I'm aware that that's very different from anything that has ever happened. In particular, there seemed, I think of how our own sympathies are sort of rallied in the way that presentation, I think against the Sardaukar, for instance, right? Very, very much like focused on the payoff of like seeing the Sardaukar finally get theirs, right? When the one formation that's standing there, and then like the sandworm just kind of comes down on him, right? And then the Fremen, you know, coming in, and that as somebody was referring to earlier on, the queer parallels between Chani's fight sequence in the battle and Paul's fight sequence in the battle at the in the vision that he had at the end of film one, right?
Yeah, I think the ending battle is so it definitely has that effect of, you know, root for Team Paul, root for Team Fremen. It also has the effect of making the end of the book more of a military victory than a political victory. And, you know, with the when Herbert elides over the battle in the book, the focus is on that courtroom scene where it's Paul, the Emperor, Count Fenring, who's not in the movie, but, you know, Count Fenring. And yeah, there's the knife battle with Fade and Paul, but that's not ultimately what determines the fate of the known universe. It's Paul saying that he plans to destroy the spice, and the Basin Guild, which doesn't play this role in the movie, essentially pushes the Emperor to abdicate, saying interstellar commerce is not possible without the spice. Paul is blackmailing us, and we believe that Paul will carry through on his threat, so therefore Paul has so, you know, worms crashing in the starter car, Paul killing Fate, that was, you know, even if that all happened, like, Paul still could have lost. And something that I'm still, I think, something in the movie that I'm still a bit, I'm not sure if it's something the world building didn't quite work, or if I just don't understand the world building of the film well enough. But, like, in the book, ships could bomb planets with, you know, orbital bombardment or, like, atomic weapons. And so if the Emperor abdicated and the Great Houses did not accept Paul as Emperor, they could literally have flown a ship around Arrakis and drop bombs on him and ended the problem. But that doesn't happen, because in the book, the Great Houses accept Paul because he's starting to destroy spice. In the movie, though, the Great Houses say that they don't accept Paul's abdication, which leads me to just wonder, like, why then do they just not attack? What, like, you know, the movie launches immediately into the jihad, as if the jihad is Paul's military conquest to secure the throne from the Great Houses. So it does come across much more, again, as like a military
victory, yeah,
as opposed to like Paul bluffing, Paul blackmailing his way into power.
Yes, I agree. The book is more invested in a kind of balance of military politics and economics, right? As like, and all three of those things are all going on there in the blackmailing that Paul does at the end. Whereas I agree, it does seem to be kind of all about the military. I think this is me guessing, but there were places where the film seemed to really simplify some things. So like with the jihad, right? Like in the book, especially at the end, there's a question you could be left with, like, okay, so we're told, Paul says at the end, like, we know Paul thinks at the end, like, okay, the jihad is now inevitable. But I remember reading this book as a teenager and being like, why? He won. Like, what's the fight? Like, why? Which, can he just say to the Fremen, like, hey, y'all, just, like, stay home, chill. Like, it's fine. Like, we won. Like, just, like, we can do whatever. It's just, like, how about, I have an idea. How about we not kill billions of people? Maybe we just not do that, right? Whereas in the film, they seemed like they wanted to make the jihad a mechanism, right? I mean, that's in the end what they did, right? Like, the jihad was going to turn out to be necessary in order for him to obtain the power that he was going to obtain. And so they made it not a consequence of him taking power, which is what it seems to be in the book, but the mechanism for him obtaining power. Which is at least simpler than the book version.
It's a bit more understandable.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking of things that were simplified. I'm going to destroy the spice by nuking it. right? Which, first of all, not, well, okay, I was going to say it's not super convincing. The way he's going to destroy the spice in the book, like, I don't even, I pretend to understand the chemistry of that, but I don't really, right? I mean, I'm completely taking it on faith that that will work. Maggie, to explain briefly, like, it's like a whole chemical thing. You remember the baby sandworm and the like juice that gets, you know, the pre-spice juice that gets sucked out of it, the water of life. If you like put the water of life, if you, what's the formula again? You guys can correct me. First you have to convert the water of life, and then you like mix it into a pre-spice mass, and it starts a chain reaction that destroys all the spice. So like the power to destroy the spice, like you have to understand the spice and, you know, like Arrakis ecology and chemistry in order to, like, you can't just nuke it, right? Like, yeah. It's not that simple. It's this whole sort of elaborate and also like sort of quasi mystical process as well. And so I have to admit, I was a little bit disappointed when he was like, we have atomics again. We can nuke the spice with it. And I'm like, seriously, that's the plan? Nuke the spice? But I was like, okay, maybe we don't want to explain the whole business with it. Though they did the thing with the baby, the drowning the baby sandworm. So we were like already pretty close to it, right? It wouldn't have been that far off. Yeah, anyway, so, but certainly it seemed to be one of several ways in which there seemed to be a choice for efficiency. You know, efficiency seemed to be something that Villeneuve wanted to gain at several points. That one, the nuking the spice, was like one of the most obvious to me of, and was like, okay, let's just granted the premise that Paul has the power to destroy it, you know, well, let's proceed forward with the rest of the story from there.
I don't have an answer to that, but I feel like we're getting to the end and I want to know what are things that you guys are like excited for or still mad about, or, you know, anything else that kind of comes to your mind about this one before we, right.
Especially as we look towards like possible next films and stuff,
which might still be 5 years away.
Ugh. Oh no!
Right.
I'm actually really looking forward to a third movie if it happens, because I think that, the, you know, there's plenty of stories out there about good and evil, good versus evil. The, you know, every summer we have multiple movies like that. But I think what we're being given by Frank Herbert in the Dune novels is something different, something that makes, that can make us sort of step back and say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we put a lot of faith in superheroes. Maybe that's not such a good thing. Let's rethink that. So I think what we have here is we've been set up with 2/3 of that, perhaps. So I'm looking forward to another third that might communicate that.
Yes. Yes. I wonder, Trevor, in that same regard, I wonder if there are ways in which the third film may even change how we feel about that division in Fremen society that felt a little clumsy in film two. I wonder if that's going to kind of pay off in some different kind of way that we're not seeing yet in the third film. It might not, but it's something that I'm kind of holding out hope for in some ways.
I think some of the changes we've discussed with Chani, with Aaliyah, like those could have an impact on the third film. It's the story of Dune Messiah very much involves those characters in certain roles at certain times. So on the one hand, the Dune purist or fan of me is a bit worried, because I'm like, well, hey, Chani and Paul aren't together, then what happens to the kids and this and that. On the other hand, though, I could see some interesting possibilities, like what Trevor suggested about Chani being the prophet, or maybe we have a younger Aaliyah in Dune Messiah, and I think they're potentially, I think like Denis Villeneuve is a good filmmaker. So what we get will be interesting. It might not be perfect. It might not be the best adaptation of Dune, but it will be an interesting film. Beautiful visual, sound, etc. And I think there are real opportunities to make it, play around with things. Like, we didn't talk much about Jessica, but Jessica's character in this film was very different from the book.
So very different. Yeah.
It was a great way to hammer home the themes of how the Bene Gesserit were manipulating religion. The one thing I would hope a little bit more from Dune Messiah, if we get it, which I think we will, is a little bit more dialogue. I kind of miss the banter or some of the dialogue scenes. And I know Denis Villeneuve is not a big fan of dialogue heavy scenes in movies, but I think Dune Messiah is going to require a little bit more of that, even than Dune did.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. That will be an interesting thing to see.
I feel like we haven't seen the subtlety of the political shifts. It has felt a lot more of the military stuff that I think it'll be interesting to see a little bit more of the nuance of these characters and not just the fate and the military role they want to fulfill.
And I think there are potentially, anyway, even hints of that kind of a shift, right? Thinking about the shift from, the Emperor Shaddam IV and his Sardaukar versus like the much more nuanced political sophistication of Princess Irulan, right? And the Bene Gesserits, right? This sense of like, a shift from one mode to the other. And and since I suspect that the final battle at the end of the second film, I wouldn't expect the big resolution, like the final conflict, ultimately to be military. Like, we've established the Fremen are going to win, right? That's not the question anymore, unless there is going to be some kind of uprising or, but anyway, yeah, what I would expect, is that it seemed anyway, potentially, Maggie, that I was thinking it could be shifting to that kind of, we're going to end in that world of more subtle politics, having done the military thing in film two, and then exploring the post-military fallout, political fallout of that later on. There are some things that kind of felt that way.
And I feel like they've set the characters and the cast up so well. Like you guys were saying, the performances were just incredible, that I think the nuance and that level of kind of interaction instead of just the explosions on screen will work because they put the work in for the first two.
Yeah. There's a lot of talking in Dune Messiah, so.
Yeah. Cool. Excellent. Well, it's getting late, and I want to keep you guys all night. Thank you guys for joining us. Always great to hear your thoughts on Dune. We will wait super patiently for the next Dune film to come out.
Don't wait super patiently. We'll find more reasons to talk about it, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But there's a Dune TV series coming out.
There is?
Yeah, Dune, I think it's Dune Prophecy.
Oh, I did not know this.
Is that designed to be like a spinoff, or?
Yeah.
Is it at all connected to this? I mean, the same production or anything?
It is. It's from the same production company. They haven't released very much about it, but it's supposed to be, I think initially it was supposed to be following the Bene Gesserit, but I don't know if that's still the current plan, but it does seem to be moving ahead.
Interesting. Okay.
Let's hope it is not Rings of Power. So.
That's a discussion for another day.
That is a discussion for another day. Indeed. that'll be interesting to see how they approach that different kind of storytelling and what they incorporate into a sort of a spin-off idea. Yeah, really interesting. Awesome. Well, thanks guys again. We'll talk again another time. And as Maggie says, we'll probably find reasons to talk about Dune again sooner or later. But thanks everybody for joining us. Next week, Maggie, do we have a plan for next week? Do we have homework?
We don't have a plan, but we're on, right? We're both available.
We're both available next week. So yeah, we'll definitely be on next week, and we'll be back to our regular time next week.
Yeah, normal time, and we'll come up with a plan, and we'll stick it on social media if you have any homework.
Very good. All right, excellent. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Nice to see you guys around. Bye now.
Take care.